Fall is all about cozy comforts, and with Hero Bread, you can enjoy all your favorites and still hit your health goals. From breakfast bagels and meal-prepped enchiladas to mouth-watering burgers and cheesy noodles, you won't believe Hero Bread's options have 0 to 5 grams net carbs and are high fiber from the taste and texture. And right now, Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code FALL25 at checkout. That's FALL25 at hero.co. All figures are per serving of Hero Bread. Contains 2 to 18 grams of fat per serving. See the product nutrition panels on hero.co for more information.
I have been looking forward to this interview for the past 7 days because guerrilla tactics, how to save a species. Greg Cummings, whose book Guerrilla Tactics is the remarkable journey of quote unquote an inveterate hustler moving from the universe of Arthur C. Clarke to the volcanoes of Varinga. Greg pursues the very rich and the very famous, always for one single goal, a passion and raison d'etre, the survival of the gorilla. It's an extraordinary account of an extraordinary life. Delighted to say the author of Guerrilla Tactics, How to Save a Species, is joining us live from Kenya. Greg, good afternoon to you, sir.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Yeah, very good. I think the last time we spoke was, what, 4 or 5 years ago when your first book came out?
Yeah, I think it was even further back than that.
Blimey. So where do we find you? Whereabouts are you today, then? You're in Kenya, I believe.
Yeah, in Malindi on the Kenya coast, enjoying the warmth.
Yeah, I have seen photographs because we have a mutual friend who often posts about that as well. And it looks absolutely gorgeous, does Malindi?
It is. It's been a bit hot lately, but it's...
So this is a book about your lifelong passion with gorillas. For those of you who don't know about your situation, they may know... obviously, the plight of the gorillas in Rwanda through Diane Fossey and the movie Gorillas in the Mist. But just give me, if you like, the Greg Cummings 101.
Yeah, okay. I kind of fell into the job back in 91. I was riding on the number 31 bus in London and looking through the Guardian want ads, and this gorilla job jumped out at me, grabbed me by the throat, and I never looked back.
When you say a gorilla job, but did it say, you know, young person needed to come and look after mythical?
No, basically, they wanted someone to run the organization, and I had been working in fundraising by then for a couple of years. It was the kind of job that I was looking for, but I really didn't think I'd get it. But that was in London, and then we were setting up our project in Africa, in Rwanda, Uganda, and Congo. And we took a different approach. We decided that we really needed to address the issues of poverty and pressures from population to get the long-term survival of the gorillas sorted. And that in a nutshell is how we got to the nub of the problem.
This is the thing, isn't it? Because it's all very well to say, oh, look at these magnificent creatures, something, and then go, something must be done, and sort of, I don't know, do the US Marines airdrop situation and clear things up for a couple of days or a couple of months or a couple of years. But education, and nothing exists in a vacuum. So presumably letting the population, changing the mindset of the population who are impoverished and trying to use and trying to get a better life no matter how.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what you need to do. Changing that mindset. And if you can change the mindset of people who live right up against this threatened species, then you have your protectors. You have you've created a front line of protection, and it becomes the opposite of trying to fight off a constant threat. And I think it's one of the big gaps in conservation, wildlife conservation, is really addressing the human issue, and it can't be really dealt with separately. You have to have a holistic approach to make it work.
What was the reaction of people when you kind of got there the first time? What was your own reaction for getting there? Were you a quote unquote an older Africa hand? Because Africa, as the saying was, there goes, Africa is different, isn't it? I mean,
It's not for sissies.
It's not for sissies.
No, Africa's not for sissies. No, I'd grown up here, so that gave me a bit of an advantage. In Africa, especially, you kind of think you need to think of problems in terms of their long-term solutions. There's nothing that could be fixed in a quick way. And so, you know, we put on our long-term vision goggles and thought, okay, this could take us 30 years. And I think that really freed us up in the early days as well to take our time and see how things change. And they did change in time. But, you know, we had the war to begin with, which was really difficult. The war in Rwanda and the genocide happened, shortly after I started my job. These were huge complications. And what I thought was a niche career, a niche vocation, suddenly, you know, was thrust into the limelight. And you know, people were asking, how on earth can you save gorillas when people are in such dire circumstances? But it was our raison d'etre. And of course, we had to, and for the sake of those people, this is their national heritage and its value is inestimable. So I think, yeah, it was a good tactic, but lots of people were skeptical about what we were trying to do to begin with.
I mean, here's the thing. I mean, if you are in the middle of probably the greatest brutality we've visited on any country in the late 20th century, we kind of think, okay, Rwanda, because hey, it's making the news in the UK at the moment for all different sort of reasons. But otherwise, people will remember Rwanda for two things. One, for David Attenborough's Life on Earth broadcast in the 70s, and B, the genocide. And we tend to think, those who've seen Hotel Rwanda will think, okay, the whole country was affected. Everything was a melting pot. Everybody, you know, there were atrocities going left, right, and center. Here's the thing that just struck me, Greg, is, you know, were you there when you were up in the rainforest? Was this getting through to you? Was it a constant problem? Or did you have gangs of armed people turning up to wreak havoc up there?
Oh yeah, they did wreak havoc. They trashed the research center that Diane Fossey set up in the mountains more than once. And, you know, we had to start from scratch. We had to also evacuate our international staff more than once. This was quite a cost. And it occurred to me that, you know, if we could hire locals and work with locals more, then the cost would come down. And so it kind of the situation dictated the way we set up the program. You know, it was too difficult for us to manage certainly in that time in 94 when the genocide was happening, and there were subsequent security issues, and there were beforehand as well. And that whole atmosphere was very difficult to manage, but it helped when we decided to take a sort of let a thousand flowers bloom approach and dealt with lots of little local organizations and got them going and boosted their efforts to mitigate the impact that people were having on the gorilla habitat.
How difficult was it to plant those flowers, those thousand flowers then? Or were, you know, are people, because, you know, we tend to, oh, well, you know, we've got the bad guys, we've got the poachers, we've got, you know, the so-and-sos who are going to, you know, shoot, there's a market out there, they need the money. It's very easy to caricature, because again, we don't know enough about Africa and Europe, really. We just have, you know, it is still the dark continent for loads of us. You know, you ask somebody to point to Zaire on a map and they'll just look at blank you and probably, you know, you'll point to Namibia or something. So.
It's the bright continent for me. You know, we've all of us came from here originally. And it's a sunny place. I don't know why it got the moniker dark continent, because it's always bright here, you know. It's like, except when the night hits, and then it's quite sudden. But yeah, it was difficult to do to begin with, and but the transformation of the national pride that Rwandans have in their gorillas is indicative of how well we did. Because and when I first got there, I remember buying one of those classic wildlife photographs with all the animals on it in the country, and they had, you know, elephant, lion, giraffe. No gorillas. And this is Rwanda, for which we think solely as a place of gorillas now. And so they really took on the campaign and decided, all right, this is something we want to protect. And so it was all the right things at the right time when it finally came together.
And you're not only dealing with them with environmental groups and local people. I should imagine at some point, this, because it's Africa, everything becomes political. So dealing with African politicians must have been a particular skill set that you learned quickly.
Oh, yeah, definitely. But, you know, when we finally got commitments from very high up, then things started to change. You know, when I took Daryl Hannah, the actress, to see gorillas, you know, we had a meeting with Paul Kagame, the president of Rwanda, afterwards. And I remember her asking me, is there something you want me to push when we see him? I said, yeah, they want to build a gorilla sanctuary up near the park. And it's something we're dead set against because in no time it'll become a zoo. So when the time came, you know, she asked that question of Paul Kagame, and he was quite forthright about his determination to save them. And he told us when, you know, he was a rebel in the forest, he made a point of making sure his soldiers did not harm gorillas. And then he finally got to see them as president. He went up and paid a visit. And, you know, he's one of the most stalwart protectors of him. So it's when you, yes, you have to deal with the politicians, but once you convince them, you know, the path is open.
Now, here's the thing, because a lot of people, you just dropped Daryl Hannah casually into the conversation, like, you know, the lovely Daryl Hannah. She's 100% activist, isn't she? There's no filter with her. She is absolutely committed to environmental causes.
Oh, she's fantastic. You know, she was just everything you wouldn't expect from a Hollywood star. Low maintenance. She was up early in the morning. She worked with the boys. We went out trekking every day, and then every night she stayed up till 1-2 in the morning making sure the video we were filming got edited and sent back to California for broadcast. So she was, and you know, I remember on her way to the airport, we were driving her and she kept saying, "Pull over here," and she'd stop, she'd go back in the back of the car and grab a dress from her rollerboard and hand it out to some woman on the side of the road. And by the time we got to the airport, she'd basically given away all of her luggage. And that was so impressive. She was she's a wonderful human being and a really good supporter of the cause.
About 1,000 years ago, I got involved. I interviewed some friends of mine who ended up setting up War Child, which was ended up with Pavarotti and Bono, and it was all Sarajevo and the whole thing. And I remember interviewing, you know, the head of War Child at the time, and it was just after Diana had done the landmine thing, and everybody was going, "Oh, well, you see, it's," and War Child were involved in landmines, and they were going, "Oh, but this is just virtual signals, you know, this is virtuous signals, and we've got this. This is before social media." And he said to me something. He said, "Look, I don't really give a flying burrito." Those weren't the exact words, but a flying burrito about what Diana gets out of it. But if it gives us publicity and it gets people to look at the situation again, I don't give a flying burrito what she gets out of it, because we've put that into people's minds. And with a Daryl Hannah, though she is obviously committed to the cause, with a Leonardo DiCaprio, and that's an interesting one, every woman swoons to say the name, people say, "Oh, they're just virtuous signalling," but you seem to have got the knack of attracting people who are, because it's hard work. You know, it's not, you don't rock up at the airport, there's a gorilla, you take a selfie, and then you're out, you know, are you?
No, it's hard work, for sure. And you know, there is a way, you meet on mutual ground, And the best celebrity sponsors of causes understand this. There's something they get out of it, but it's more that the charity gets out of it. And you know, it's an agreement that we're going to make the most of the situation and use their name. I mean, I actually met Princess Diana early in my fundraising career. I was working for a drugs and alcohol rehab in London, and she was patron, and it was one of these lineups at an event that we were hosting, and she asked me directly. She said, "Are you using me?" You know, I blushed for her choice of words, but her point was exactly that. You know, what's the point of having me on your letterhead? You have to make a point of using my name to open doors for you and to make possibilities for the organization. And that was an important early lesson, because in later years, I would come up working with a lot of different celebrities. And I found that understanding that they're there so that their name can be used to support the cause was important, and not getting it caught up in, you know, other kinds of flattery. So it is a mutual arrangement between celebrity and the cause.
The book is called Guerrilla Tactics, How to Save a Species. And for the, you know, for people who don't keep up with it, we kind of thought that ever since we'd had Diane Fossey and these high profile campaigns that the gorillas were relatively safe, or am I completely wrong on that one, Greg? And this is why you've written Guerrilla Tactics.
Well, it's, I mean, it is a conservation success story, in fact, one of few. You know, when I started, the number of gorillas was about 650, and now they're over 1,000. So that's an indication right there that, things are going well for them. But there's still only 1,000, and they're surrounded by densely populated communities of, people. And, you know, it's a constant thing. We have to keep, maintain that equilibrium, that balance, so that everybody's benefiting, and, the gorillas mostly, and the situation continues to go on like that. But it, so the book is a recap on what's happened really since Diane was killed in 85. I started in 91, and the book takes us all the way up to 2006 in the gorilla story, and then I sort of recap in the end. But it's at the same time as I was doing all this work, I was also burning out. And it's a story of, maybe people will be surprised, it's I'm a bit of an anti-hero in this. I don't paint myself in a particularly flattering picture, because it took its toll on me. In the end, I had to, you know, bow out. And so that's it. In a way, it's a story of that, and the struggle of getting heavily involved in a cause, and, the kind of toll it can take on you, but also lots of triumphs and great antidotes. The stories just came out when I was writing it. I thought, wow, this I'm writing this so quickly, I can't believe it. Then I thought, I've been dining out on these stories for the decades, you know, beforehand, so I know them really well. And so I was quite pleased when I was writing the book that I could remember so much. Of course, I caught up with old friends, and they reminded me and filled in some of the gaps.
Yes, indeed. This is the thing, because we tend, you know, to think of people who work in charity, you know, almost, I mean, I'm looking at you now with your long flowing hair. I mean, short of a halo there, Greg. I mean, people, oh, it's, you know, it's the blessed Saint Cummings of Greg. I mean, exactly, people don't realize that you've got to work. And, you know, again, my friends work with War Child, and there was Pierre who was killed in Ukraine, and there's Mish, and they worked their proverbials off. I mean, they were muddy, they were fed up, they were effed off. You know, they were screaming and shouting to get things done. And, you know, they liked to party as well, because you need to blow steam off. So it's not this situation, yeah, that you were arrive, you know, with great backlighting, you know, and you don't get bitten by 8,000 different species of insects in your sleeping bag, and people, yeah, can burn out of charity, because it's not like being a major corporate head. You can't have a CEO. You can't, you know, piddle off to St. Bart's for the weekend and, or, you know, take the yacht out to, you know, to Rhode Island. You're living it 24/7.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that was it with me. I mean, I guess I couldn't turn it off. I lived it. And of course, you never paid enough to leave your job and go home and sleep soundly. It's all about the emotion that you're involved in, and the emotive quality of the cause, and how you're drawn in by that motivation. That's what kept me going. And when that became, in a way, too intense, and I began to burn out in the final chapters of this book, you start to read about that. It was interesting for me to look back, because, you know, I've come a long way since then, but I recognized that I was really in a bad place by the end of it.
I mean, how difficult is it, again, to because you can't turn it off and walk away and say, I'll come back on Monday. I mean, I've interviewed people who are psychologists who do profiles on serial killers, and they say, luckily, I have this thing in my head, and I just turn it off and go home and have lunch, you know, dinner with my family. But, you know, gorillas don't care about timetables, and poachers certainly don't care about timetables, and environmental issues don't get, okay, it's 4:30 on a Friday, I'll see you Monday at 9, do they?
Yeah, no, absolutely not. I mean, that was another thing that struck me writing the book, was how quickly these events happened one after the other. I mean, when I thought of them, and looking back, I would pick one out and think, oh, that was interesting. But when I put them all together, I thought, good Lord, this is like an accordion of intense moments. And I never got a chance really to see what had happened in the last situation we come to before another one was happening. And that, I think, comes across in the book, the intensity of it. But, you know, it's a double-edged sword. That's what kept me going. And in the end, it's what cut me out.
So I'm intrigued about your writing style. Did you just sort of sit there and it, you know, opened a bottle of something and it all came out while sitting on a luxurious beach place in Malindi, and it just came? Or was it discipline that you just had to get this one going?
Yeah, well, actually, I was in Cabo San Lucas when I wrote this, and with my wife and my aging mother. And my wife, Roberta, she's amazing. She was looking after my mom and making sure I had the time to write. And I did have the time. I had, you know, 6 hours a day, 6 days a week when I worked on this. And it flowed, but it was not like my other books. My previous two books were fiction, and the one I'm working right now is fiction as well. And that's a much more plodding process. But I didn't realize a memoir would just come flowing, because as the name suggests, it's your memories. And when you put them all together, it does flow quite easily. And I was surprised how easy it was for me to write that book.
And what's the...
I wrote it in five months.
5 months. That's turbocharged, yeah, Greg. That's turbocharged.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I mean, we're talking about Rwanda, but again, it's, you know, guerrillas don't exactly... They don't say, okay, we can't go over there because that's the next country. So what's the situation now? The last time you sort of checked on it, what is the situation with, you know...
Rwanda's a pretty stable place. Yeah. But yeah, as you say, the guerrillas, they don't know borders. And in fact, back then, they were stuck between a rock and a hard place. When I first started, Uganda was the most safest place in their habitats, of their habitats. And of course, Congo is also one of the countries where they range through, and difficulties there made it very difficult for conservation. But again, the numbers have gone up. So it's a case of getting on top of the situation and making sure that all three areas where the mountain gorillas range are, you know, protecting them. Otherwise, the weakest link in the chain makes it impossible to achieve the bigger outcome. So yeah, Congo, Uganda, Rwanda, these are all countries with dodgy pasts, and so it was a challenge, definitely, getting it all together for them. But at the moment, you know, they're doing quite well.
And just quickly, there's pictures of you, obviously sitting amongst. What do we call a collective now for gorillas? By the way, you've got me on that one.
A group of gorillas.
Yeah. Okay, a group of gorillas. What's it like when you first saw them? Because I mean, I don't mean to get all spiritual and say, well, you know, my life's transformed and a bright shining light again came from above. But what is it like amongst them?
Well, it is an amazing experience, because most wild animals are viewed from inside the protection of a metal, you know, vehicle, and you see a rhino and he starts charging. You're not that worried that he's going to destroy you. But a gorilla that gets up when you're sitting there in the wild and starts beating his chest can be extremely exhilarating, frightening, depending on how you look at it. And you know, you're told, whatever happens, don't run. And this guy is coming at you like a freight train, with, you know, pulling up roots and everything. And you've got to stay there, because, I mean, if you run, you're toast. That's for sure. And your best option is to say to him, look, you don't want to do this with me today, in a kind of attitude that's quite submissive. And you, the most important thing when a gorilla is charging you is to acknowledge that he's the boss. If you stand up and try and confront him, that's the end for you. And I've never had a physical interaction. A couple of times the gorillas punched me. But, you know, most of the time they're there. They're happy for you to be there. You know, oh, here come the bald apes again. And let's sit with them for an hour, because it's entertaining, let's be honest. And for them, as much as it is for us, they have fairly boring days just sitting around eating leaves. So when we come along, it's the highlight of their day. And I think understanding that there is, again, a mutual ground where we meet with wildlife, it is extremely special as an experience with wild animals for that reason alone. I mean, I remember Dad, who you mentioned to begin with, saying after his encounter, and I'm paraphrasing here, if there was any way you could escape the human condition and live imaginatively, it would be with a gorilla. And he's absolutely right. That quote just, you know, was stuck in the back of my head through my whole career. And I thought, yeah, maybe one day I'll just give up and go live with them.
the naked ape, indeed. We're only 12 days into January, but you've just given me the quote of the year. You know, I've only been punched by a gorilla a few times. I mean, that begs the question, what's it like to be punched by a gorilla?
Oh yeah, I mean, they hit you. It's usually the younger ones. They're trying to show to the silverback, the alpha male, that they're worthy adjutants. So they'll come along after the whole show has moved on and just give you a thump to say, yeah, you know, just think about what happened if you did something. And it's that kind of bravado, but it's never, you know, it doesn't even leave a bruise, but you feel it. I mean, I remember the researchers telling me stories of this one gorilla who was quite mischievous, Pablo, and he would come along and sit down beside you and put his arm on you. And you thought, oh my God, this is great. But what you didn't realize is he'd grabbed your backpack and then he'd start running. And you'd be dragged bass-ackwards through the foliage with this gorilla, you know, playing with you, basically. So I'm glad I didn't have that experience. And, but generally speaking, they are quite gentle.
You put a quote on social media because I stalk you because, hey, what's the guy to do? But the other day, and I thought it was quite profound because you said there was a gorilla, a female gorilla, who passed away of natural causes in the jungle. And you said that proves that we are doing the right thing because that's the way we want it to go.
Absolutely. That's the ticket right there. You know, a gorilla dies of old age. Wow. Okay. Lived a long, healthy life up in their habitat. And, you know, that individual gorilla probably encountered other gorillas, had problems with them, and may even have come across a poacher or two. But they lived through a full life, and that is the ultimate goal, is to have them live their natural life in the wild.
What do you hope that people take, learn, discover from guerrilla tactics?
I'm hoping other conservationists pick up on the message of the, you know, humans and gorillas, because I really do paint that picture in there and explain the methodology that we used. So that's quite important. But I hope people understand that the mechanics behind the scenes of these, you see these beautiful images of animals and to understand how things work and you know, the ups and downs and the pitfalls. And I mean, there's more failures than triumphs in this story, but each one, it comes across like a triumph because the process of, you know, the middle of the book, I talk about working with Douglas Adams to approach Bill Gates for a very large sum of money. And it took us 3 years. And in the end, we weren't successful, but the process was so interesting. And I expect other fundraisers and other conservationists will find that interesting. And just the general public will think, wow, I never knew that this was the way things had to work. So yeah, I'm hoping that it'll open up, you know, people's awareness of how difficult, but also the triumphs and tragedies that come with doing this kind of work.
The book is called Gorilla Tactics, How to Save a Species. It's by Greg Cummings, who we're speaking to today. Greg, if people want to find you on the social medias, on the website, I know you're a little bit active on you because I said before, I stalk you on a regular basis. So where can they find you?
It's Greg Cummings' author page on Facebook is where I do most of my book promoting. I also have an organization called Blue Gorilla Giving Consultancy. And that's where I still continue to do the kind of work I was doing with the gorillas and for other organizations and setups around the world.
Just say that again. Was that Blue Gorilla Giving?
Yeah, Blue Gorilla Giving. As bluegorillagiving.ca is the website, and that's where, yeah, that's Greg Central. That's where all my ideas get circulated, and it's on the book. They're on the cover of the book, so I expect I'm going to get some inquiries after this book comes out.
Absolutely, the book is called Gorilla Tactics: How to Save a Species. You'll be able to order it as well on our own virtual bookstore as well. Greg Cummings, author and journal, all around good egg. Listen, it's been wonderful to catch up with you. Let's not leave it another 8 years. But Greg Cummings, have a great weekend. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Charles. Great talking to you again, mate.